I have a little bit of a different topic than the ones that you've been seeing over the course of the day, and you know, it's all about looking at a context for what we do that perhaps we don't understand as well enough as we should. So I want to start out by actually asking you to think about a couple of scenarios before I delve into my slides. The first is this a question with regard to publication of scientific information. I think y'all are well aware that during World War II, you know, in the concentration camps, some truly heinous experiments took place, and using unwilling concentration camp victims as participants in those studies. And there has been efforts made over the past 10 years or so to attempt to try to publish the results of those research, with the argument being offered that perhaps the best way to honor the sacrifices of the people who died in those experiments would be to somehow allow for some actual scientific information to be generated from the research that was done. The question I have for you, and I don't expect you to vocalize that an answer right now, is do you think that's appropriate? Do you think that that is a good thing to do? So keep that one in mind for just a minute while I throw out another scenario. This one is closer to home. It involves discussions that we had within the Palmer Center when I was still a member of the Palmer Center. We were grappling with the issue of how to recruit participants for a number of competing studies. We had two studies in which we needed to accrue patients with low back pain, and one of them went live before the other. And because the one went live before the other, the advertisements that we were running in the local press were specific to that particular study. When we had a second study, it became apparent that, you know, if somebody was ineligible for one study, they might be eligible for one of the other studies, and the question came up as to how we go about informing them. If they were calling in because they read a flyer for the one study that we had flyers out at the time, would it be ethical for us, once they were rejected for participation in the one study, would it be ethical for us to then let them know that there was a second one? And if so, in what way could we do that? And this led to some rather heartfelt discussions that were detailed and difficult. And I recall at one point in time, one of our faculty members saying, you know, look, I don't understand what the big deal is. We're just trying to help them. And so my question is that true? Is that all we're trying to do in clinical research? And is that the only goal that we have when we do clinical research? So keep those two scenarios in mind as I begin to paint a little bit of a picture of what modern bioethics is about. This is not a topic that I think a whole lot of people within chiropractic are conversant with. I've sort of fallen in love with it a little bit, and so, you know, I thought that it might make a sensible presentation to talk about here. So here's the skinny. You know, what we're looking at is the fact that the complexity of our research has been steadily increasing over the course of the past 10 years. If you think about the kind of presentations that you've seen even here today, studies that are done in VA centers, studies that are done in chiropractic colleges, what you're seeing is a level of complexity that's well beyond what existed, let's say, 20 years ago. And we've got now projects that are involving, you know, in some cases, 17, 18, 20, 25 different people that are working on behalf of a particular project that may collaborate between different institutions, and now we're going through multiple IRBs. We've got different kinds of things that we have to take into account. We heard earlier today, you know, in the VA setting, that every time they do something, there's a different IRB for every single setting that they work in. Lots of complexity that's going on. What it means is that as we plan our projects, we have a much greater need to attend to the ethical underpinnings of what we're doing in our research studies. And from my perspective, you know, sort of a little bit of a biased perspective, you know, I don't think that this is something that we can necessarily leave only up to the IRB. I can't speak to, you know, what happens at the IRB in a military setting. I can speak a little bit to what I've seen happen in IRB settings within chiropractic, and there are times where I feel that the reviews are relatively cursory, that the issues that you need to grapple with in some of these more complex situations are not adequately being addressed. So I think that, you know, if we feel that the onus for appropriate ethics lies solely at the foot of the IRB, we're going to be making a very bad mistake. That responsibility is yours as well, particularly those of you that are conducting research. Now, just as an example, Dr. Hondris and I conducted a survey at Palmer looking at faculty understanding of when they needed to seek IRB approval for educational research, and what we found was that by and large faculty did not understand when they needed to apply to the IRB for research that they were doing in at that particular point in time. It was for classroom setting kinds of research. For example, if you wanted to run a survey in your classroom that you later wanted to perhaps present at a conference such as this, people didn't understand what they needed to do in order to do those kinds of studies. Now, you know, our hard scientists, people that are working in research settings, are, we would like to believe, more conversant with this, but in fact, our research found that they were not especially conversant with these issues as well. You know, I think their perspective was, in their case, they were always going to apply to the IRB. When we began to ask them questions about what they needed to do in educational settings, they didn't know. So, truth is, very few people within our profession have any background in bioethics, you know, but it's that's at a time where the need for people with this kind of expertise really has never been greater. And so from my perspective, you know, a little bit of theory is going to help inform what we do when we analyze, you know, ethical situations for educational research, for scientific research. Again, I don't really want to draw a distinction between those things. I've fallen into sort of a thinking pattern where I do. Hard for me to break out of it, but it's all research. So I want to look a little bit at the kinds of theories that exist within modern bioethics. So I'm going to look at several different approaches. Okay, some of these you're probably going to be aware of. Some of these you're undoubtedly have never heard of. But my point in doing this is to sort of give you an idea of the differing ways in which we can consider ethical situations and bring our intelligence to light into resolving problems that can crop up. And in fact, these problems may very well be within a research setting, they may be within a practice setting, a clinical setting. It really sort of doesn't matter because the theories are pretty much the same. So I'm going to start out. I've actually been obsessing over this, so I've been jotting notes down over the course of the day. But I want to start out by just doing a little bit of definitional stuff before I delve into the particular theories. I want to make a broad division of general ethical theory into two groups. One group are known, it really are the deontological ethics, and these are theories that are based around the concepts of duty or obligation. And the primary question that they're asking are, what are my duties or my obligations in this particular situation? And, you know, obviously one of the things you're going to have to define is, where are these duties or obligations coming from, if you're going to base an approach on this? And so at the end, what you do is you develop principles. And these principles are going to be followed regardless of where they may lead. So, for example, we might be able to look at something like the abortion debate for want of a better term, a right-to-life approach, as being a deontological approach that's based around a duty to God or a duty to the right to life. Okay. On the other hand, the other basic form of an approach is called, these are known as teleological ethics, and they're good-based ethics. We know them under terms like situational ethics. That is, okay, we got this situation, what do we need to do? So somehow you have to tote up the possible different responses that you can make in that particular situation and figure out which one is the best one, using whatever standards for best you might come up with. So these are sort of consequentialist things. If I do this, this is what's likely to happen. These are the consequences. But if I do that, this is what's likely to happen. So you could, you know, for example, you could sit there and say, let's see, I have a final exam tomorrow, and my favorite television program is on an hour from now, so I could watch it, and I'll lose an hour of studying, and I'll have to stay up later, so I might be a little bit more tired in the morning when I have to take my test, Or I could not watch my program and I could study so that I have a better chance of doing well and I'll feel more refreshed tomorrow. And you make a decision, okay? You have to live with the decision, all right? So what we're looking at is, you know, what's the best good that you're going to find? Now, you're going to begin to see that the challenge is defining what that best good might be. Okay. So now, a few more definitional things. When you begin to look at bioethics, and this is probably boring Mike Ramtran to tears because he's heard this already from me, but you know, when you look at bioethics and you look at how people study it, they break it down into normative and non-normative ethics. And in the goal of a normative ethical approach is to answer a basic question. Now, I've written it sort of in technical language here, which says which general norms for the guidance and evaluation of conduct are worthy of moral acceptance and for what reasons. A better way of putting this is, what are the standards for right action? You know, how do we decide the best way to do the right thing? How do we know what's right, what's wrong? That's what normative ethics is all about. It's trying to figure out what's a right action, what's a wrong action. And then when we apply that to actual living situations, that's practical ethics. Probably the leading practical ethicist is the highly controversial Peter Singer. I don't know how many of you have heard of him, but he's a person who's written, basically he was involved early on in what was called the animal liberation movement. He's also been involved in some hard decisions about what you do with newborns that are suffering from severe mental retardation, stuff like that. He's a very controversial guy, and he's been embroiled in the culture wars as a result of his work. But the bottom line is that practical ethics is applying what we determine from normative ethics into the general theories that we use for our conduct and our moral judgment. On the other hand, we have non-normative ethics, which is not, we're not concerned about developing norms. Really, what we're concerned about is describing what the heck the case is. In fact, the study that Maria and I did is a non-normative ethical study. We were looking at describing something. What is the knowledge, what's the knowledge of Palmer College faculty with regard to when they need to use the IRB? So it's a factual investigation of moral behavior and belief. I know that Gary has done some studies where he's looked at student responses to questions that are based on ethical issues. That's another descriptive thing. It tells us, oh boy, does it tell us, some pretty harsh things about what students believe to be appropriate conduct in classroom settings, for example. And then finally, there's this thing called metaethics, which is really where we look at defining terms. So when we use the term virtue, what does it mean? When we use the term principle, what does it mean? The whole idea of metaethics is to try to bring sort of a focus on the meaning of the terms that are used in ethical discussions. But descriptive ethics, for example, very empirical. I went backwards, sorry. Now, one last thing before I actually begin to bring up the different theories that we have. But as you go into the ethics literature, you're going to find that they ask that there to be a good theory, it's got to meet, there's got to be eight conditions it really has to meet in order for you to feel comfortable that this particular theory is an adequate theory to be using. It should be clear, there should be clarity, that is, it should be clear in how you use it. It should be coherent. There should be some internal consistency. Now, let me give you an example. Coherency would be, for example, that you believe that there is a right to life, and you also believe in capital punishment. That's not coherent. Okay, now when I use the word coherent here, I don't mean it in the sense of, you know, whether or not you're a raving lunatic. It's simply not coherent. On the one hand, you're saying there's a right to life. On the other hand, you're saying kill people. So, you know, on the other hand, the Catholic Church says there's a seamless garment. They're against both, you know. So it should be coherent. There should be completeness. There should be simplicity. It should have explanatory power. That is, it should help us to understand what the moral life is. Justificatory power. It should tell us what our grounds are for belief. Output, which means that it helps us make decisions, and it should be practicable. We should be able to use it. All right, so real quickly, because how much time do I have? 2 minutes, holy cow, this thing went really fast. You know,
talk faster than you know.
I can't do that.
no one can comprehend.
Yeah. You know, here's the thing. You know, with these different approaches, what you can do is you can analyze a case. So I would like to take a case, but I'm not going to have the time. So I'm going to sort of briefly touch on these theories. Utilitarianism, this is a basic approach. This is what we do every day. We make decisions about what's the best good for what we do. You know, it started with Bentham and Mill, and we just have to figure things out. The problem is, what's the basis to decide that that's the best thing to do? We never know until after the fact whether it was the best thing to do. On the other hand, the other major approach is known as Kantianism, which is the basic obligation-based theory associated with Immanuel Kant. And he basically says that an action has moral worth only if it's performed by an agent with goodwill. So, if we had a child who needed a kidney transplant, and a father was willing to donate his kidney to that child, but would not be willing to donate that kidney to anybody else, Kant would say that has no moral worth. It has to be universalized. Okay? So this is the idea of an obligation type thing. So we have to will it so that it would be for everybody in all similar circumstances. Character ethics looks at the person that's involved, and it focuses on the character of the person that's involved. It looks at virtue, the moral traits that we socially value. We say in character ethics that it's possible to perform a socially valued action from a motivation that's not morally virtuous. And if so, they would not consider that to have moral worth. Even though you do the right thing, if you do it for the wrong reason, it has no moral worth. Liberal individualism, rights, you know. We have to look at a hierarchy of rights. So if we're trying to assess a situation with the father and the daughter, we have to take into account what rights does the father have in this situation. Well, he's got a right to autonomy. He's got a right to make his own decision. What right does the daughter have in that situation? Does she have a right to life? What rights? We have to develop a hierarchy, but you can see that this will begin to conflict. Whose rights trump the other person's rights? So liberal individualism sometimes is very hard to apply. In contrast to that, we have communitarianism, where community values are especially important. Ethics is derived from those communal values, the common good. We could look at the father and the daughter and the mother in that situation and say, how would the community best be served? What communities are we talking about? The family is a small community, but they're part of a larger community. We need to consider the communal values, and obviously it repudiates liberalism. It puts much more emphasis on the community rather than the single person. There's the ethics of care, which grew predominantly out of the nursing profession. It's based on relationships. It's a little bit similar to communitarianism, but it really focuses on the relationships we have with the people that we work with. Came out of Carol Gilligan's writing, I think many of you have read In a Different Voice. And the central idea here is what they call mutual interdependence. That is that we as physicians, we should have some compassion toward the persons that we treat, and the people that we treat have to rely upon us to be treated. And so there's this mutual relationship, and our emotions become very important in the ethics of care. Finally, the last one in this thing, in my little list here, is casuistry, which is not playing the kazoo. It's basically sort of a case-based reasoning that comes out of the medieval era, fell out of favor, but it basically doesn't worry so much about rules and rights like all these others do. It's more like a legal precedent. It looks at what have past cases told us. What can we learn from the past cases that we can apply to the current case? So for an example, with this Terry Schiavo situation that came out of Florida, part of what they looked at were previous cases, particularly Karen Ann Quinlan, which was the benchmark case in what to do with permanently vegetative states, people that were in permanent vegetative states. So we build and accrue knowledge over time as we go through this process of ethical reasoning. So, bottom line is that most of us tend to be utilitarian. I think that as we go through our lives, we just sort of make decisions based on what we think is going to be the best thing to do at that particular time. Now, unfortunately, when we're looking in a research setting or we're looking at educational settings, it's a little bit different. Our research is complex. We need to understand the basis on which we make these ethical decisions so that we don't find ourselves running into problems. And I have really only touched the surface of what I consider to be a really rich, wonderful area for study, you know, that has applications well beyond just, you know, what we're doing here. But in terms of public health and in terms of the research we do, I think we're coming up short a little bit because, you know, researchers worry about getting getting participants, you know? And sometimes, you know, there's always a danger you could cut a corner, and you don't want to do that. You always want to be acting, you know, with the right moral worth in your heart when you do that. So I'm unlike everybody else. I felt that with a disclosure, you know, I have to disclose who pays my salary. So Palmer College pays my salary, and so I felt that that would be an appropriate disclosure. Thanks. Yeah, that was the fastest 15 minutes in my life.